Okay, so most of what we spoke about in growth and development in the Bjork studies and Bushang's elaboration of Bjork studies was to understand what is normal growth, what is ideal growth, what is optimum growth, what is not optimal growth, what is malocclusion, what is poor growth. So, in order for us to be able to recognize who needs help, we have to recognize who doesn't need help. So this is actually the perfect segue to the question is, well, how do we know who is appropriate, a patient? And the answer is, you should know based on your understanding of what is ideal. And this is what we're going to do. Because most people have no concept of what is ideal, what is normal. And that's why this is such a mystery. So we've done lots of studies in the 20th century, all right, to try to figure out what's normal, what's not normal. We're looking at different populations, and we're looking at different levels of imbalance, wayward growth, crowding, spacing, and there are large-scale population studies that we have been fortunate enough to be able to gain access to. The longitudinal studies, cephalometric longitudinal studies, have been instrumental in our ability to get some sense of normality and classifications of malocclusion. One of the biggest collections is the Case Western Bolton Brush Growth Study, and you can actually use this as a link to get access to all this data, because this data is publicly accessible. And generally, whenever there is no control in a study, such as in my study and in studies that are retrospective, we often go to this legacy collection of data, and we try to source a matched control to get some perspective. Right. So we've had fortune that every nation has been interested in malocclusion because it's prevalent in every nation. And so we know the normal and abnormal growth patterns of every race and every and each gender of child. One very interesting study was done by Prophet, Bill Prophet, who started a process at the same timeline as a group of orthodontists in Australia, and they studied at the University of Adelaide. A longitudinal growth study of a specific tribe of Aboriginals. And they were able to find that almost throughout the entire population there, there was very little in the way of malocclusion. And so they were able to take study models of these children, and they found very specific space characteristics and arch forms in children who grow really, really, really well. So here we are, 5 years, almost seven, and eight and a half. So we can see how much space belongs in a 5-year-old, how incisors are supposed to erupt, and when they meet in the middle, what kind of relationship they should have. Here we are at 10. Here we are at 11. And here we are in the full permanent dentition. All right. So we start to get a sense of, oh, so this is what an arch should look like if everything is tracking nicely. And you'll notice at 14 and at 15 that things don't get any wider, but they start to get more depth. And at 16, the wisdom teeth start to come through. They didn't do a structural method of evaluation. They did what most people did in that timeline and even today, but they did SN. And they commented how prognathic these tribe of people were without really taking any consideration as to how they were able to fit their wisdom teeth into play. And of course, we know if we're supposed to get all 32 adult teeth in the play, then our face has to come forward. But the next question is, well, who wants to look like a monkey, right? And the answer is, if we don't value wisdom teeth and we accept that, we're now in a world where everyone has to have them out. The question is, if we didn't have the technology of antibiotics and maxillary facial surgery under anesthetic to remove impacted wisdom teeth, how many of our young adults would survive into maturity? If you're 18 and you've got an impacted wisdom tooth and you've got an infection and your face looks like a hamster, because that happens, and you had no access to antibiotics and you didn't have an oral surgeon who could put you to sleep to take the wisdom tooth out, how many weeks would you be able to live before you died? So let me ask you, how important is it to actually get wisdom teeth in the back? Well, when we look back historically, before antibiotics and before oral surgery was a clinical practice, we know that if we go back far enough, we very, very, very rarely found skeletal malocclusion. We found very specific characteristics of occlusion for people who could fit all their teeth naturally into play. Right. If you are going to survive into adulthood, can you develop pericoronitis of your impacted wisdom teeth and be expected to live? Now, we've all seen the 18-year-old who comes in with a face like he's trying to swallow a tennis ball. And we panic. Because we know what? If he doesn't get antibiotics and those teeth out, he's going to be in serious trouble. So we write a script and we refer to an oral surgeon or we do the operation ourselves, right? And we do it quickly within the timeline of getting the antibiotics in on that day, making sure they take that full 7 days worth so that the infection cannot be systematized. And then we try to get them booked in for an operation to take the wisdom teeth out within the month. Because we know after that month, that antibiotic effect will have dissipated. And guess what? He'll be in with a fat face again and so on and so forth. So if we are born with 52 teeth, they are supposed to fit properly. So the reality is, we know that we all stem from a very small original population. We know that for most of our existence, like the predominance of our existence, everything fitted properly. So, this is a concept that John Mew envisaged as the only logical explanation of how we were able to evolve into the dominant species on this planet. All right, we developed optimally, physically, mentally, emotionally. intellectually, spiritually. And with that dominance, there must be a relationship of the jaws that allowed every one of those teeth to fit properly. And he worked out a very specific set of measurements that made sense to fit these number of teeth. And he create got an artist to depict a, Paleolithic woman who might have those characteristics. And then it was interesting because I remember him giving this lecture and then me coming back and changing the magazines on the waiting room table of my practice. And guess what I found? On the back of a magazine, there are people on this planet where everything fits properly. We tend to put those people on a platform and stick them on magazine covers or on the big screen or the little screen because we are entranced by the correct balance of their features. And the reality is, this should be the norm. This should be the norm. And people say, oh, well, it's just specific populations, it's specific races, right? It's only Scandinavian people. Well, let me tell you, every race on Earth where things fit properly, they tend to look more alike than other characteristics, right? The skin is different. The hair is different, the eye is different, the height is different, but the bones are the same if you want to fit 52 teeth in properly. They all have low angle square jawline. They all have lips that are full and on the same plane as each other and the chin. They all have acute nasolabial angles. They all have small, straight noses. They all have high cheekbones. They all have hollow cheeks. They all rest with their mouth closed. They're not the people who are photographed with their mouth open all the time. They're all photographed with their mouth closed because that's their natural resting posture. And it doesn't matter which continent they come from, doesn't matter which culture they come from, it doesn't matter which race they originate from. Their facial bones are the same proportion and balance. But no one believes you unless there are studies. So twin studies were the foundation of many of our nature nurture concepts. And there have been plenty, right? They've done a lot of research on mitogenetic twins. Bruder did some on discord between DNA copy. Castelo Fernandez, we're looking at diseases in monozygotic twins. Coracini looked at evolutionary basis and genetics and biology. They looked at how occlusions were very different in twins of different nationalities. They looked at how much of a role genetics played, and it basically came down to malocclusion is genetic, right? Because there was too many similarities between twins. The thing that comes into play though is there was little in the way of understanding of how twins tend to be raised in the same environment. They've done studies on twins that were separated, but obviously the numbers there didn't have the power to mean anything because how often do twins get separated? So there was a lot of study orthodontically with twin studies. Here in Adelaide, they ran huge longitudinal twin studies. And they were looking at various genetically inherited diseases as well as malocclusions. John Mew did a big study where he treated one twin with fixed with orthotropics, and then he had a colleague treat the other twin with fixed braces, and then he compared the difference. He found that the method of treatment created a very big distinctive change in the skeletal presentation. So, twin research has been a very important part, and the outcome, unfortunately, has been one that sides more with the genetic predisposition to skeletal development. But from what we've learned about basic sciences and about the role of posture, we have to view our research as being biased based on a lack of understanding about the fundamentals of growth. So, when we are very specific into trying to dissect the differences between twins on a large scale, so 170 pairs of twins, so this is a nicely powered piece of research, they determine that the muscle balance achieved by lips, cheeks, and tongue may be disturbed by abnormal or habitual behavior patterns. Right? And they found that it was as much of the environment as it was genetically inheritance. So published in the European Journal of Orthodontics, so it's not a Mickey Mouse journal. This is a serious player in orthodontic peer review. So spend the time, look at some of these papers and try to understand how we came about making decisions about genetic role being the dominant factor versus the multifactorial versus the environmental factor, and look at how no one pays any attention to the basic science of how biology works. Right? Biology is a fact of life. Clinical trials are completely biased towards whatever you're trying to prove or disprove. And here's the interesting thing that no one talks about with clinical trials. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't get published. Unless you've made a decision, you want it not to have worked out to be your published work. There's a photographer called Scholar who decided he wanted to portray twins. And his documentation of reality seems to verify our orthodontic research that genetics trumps the environment, as clearly seen by how identical people are when they share the same DNA. And you would be hard pressed to argue that genetics isn't the dominant role, right? You look at these children and adults, and you would not be able to argue the point that anything but genetics is what expresses how the human face ends up, right? Because here we got identical twins with identical faces, right? Twin after twin after twin. So perfectly identical every single time. All right, so claims goes, all this orthotropics posture stuff is garbage, fringe, fantasy. But how come other twins don't quite look identical? How is it that you can have a width variation in the face of some twins? How is it you can have a vertical height difference in other twins? How is it that we aren't identical every single time when it's so obvious that it was identical in every single time in other cases? How can we have both a width and a height difference when we know there shouldn't be a width and a height difference? It's like the face is not the same, but they're identical twins sharing the same DNA. The reality is there is variation. There is enough of a transverse, a vertical, and an AP difference to actually be different. But it tends specifically to be the face and not the head that's different. So most of the time then, right? There's variation, we understand. Teeth get moved around, right? Dental alveolar is flexible. Of course, there's some differences. But how much of a difference should we expect before we start to say, well, maybe they're not identical exactly in the phenotype? Maybe we're more sibling than we are monozygotic twin. Because when you start to look at twins carefully and you have a big enough of a sample, you start to realize in the face, there are transverse differences, there are AP differences, there are vertical differences. Lots and lots and lots and lots of facial, oral, and a lot of facial and oral characteristics are very, very varied in twins. We suspect that we're always looking for things that validate our view. And we stop looking when we've found what we want. And I think it's important to keep hunting so that you have power in your study. The reality is, if you have enough numbers, you will start to see enormous variation in monozygotic twins in facial form. But you say, oh, well, two is too small a study. Sure. How about triplets? Should they all be the same? What if they're mostly the same, but they're not the same in every aspect? Is that something that has power? Is three more power than two? What about four? Is four more power than two? or three. If they are identical, sharing the same DNA, should they not be identical like the group we first saw? Like, where does the logic come into play when we have agendas to meet? The same but different, right? It's not the same as the same is the same. So, Scholler, a layperson, a photographer who made a specific effort to document differences and similarities, right? Far more in depth and detail and in precision than our profession ever does. He found variation according to variation on a theme, but variation nonetheless. And the reality is the environment has an enormous effect, doesn't it? Identical twins, monozygotic identical twins, but environmental factors have now made them just siblings. Graeber's identical twins. How long have we known this? Can the environment have an impact on your genetic expression? Yes, it can. Is Graeber someone? Graeber, who actually has an orthodontic textbook named after him? It's very important for us to recognize that we know our profession has the knowledge base for true understanding, true correction, true prevention of malocclusion, but has chosen to just focus on the symptoms. Okay, so that ends.